Hello and welcome. I am Dr. Lara May, a clinical pharmacist specializing in functional medicine, as well as a certified yoga teacher and Reiki master. I run a truly integrative health coaching practice, encompassing functional medicine lab testing, yoga and meditation, and a sprinkling of Reiki energy medicine. Join me here on Light Body Radio to break through your health plateau and come into alignment with your natural vitality. Hello and welcome to Light Body Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Lara May. And today I have with me Erin Copeland. She is a best-selling author, storyteller, licensed massage therapist, and real estate investor. In 2009, she was appointed sole caregiver to her husband as he was diagnosed with cancer, undergoing multiple surgeries, and had a successful liver transplant. With caregiving experience that spans over a decade in multiple states with multiple medical centers, Erin was called to share her story with the universe, with the underserved caregiving community. She was called to share hope, community, and love. Erin is a UNOS ambassador, helping to spread the word of the importance of organ donation. She loves riding the ocean, snuggling her kitty, and learning new ways to express her creativity. Welcome. I'm so excited. In case it wasn't clear, we're going to be talking about caregiving today.
Yay, caregiving.
Yeah, you know, this is a community of people that obviously give a lot of themselves. And, you know, and we're grateful, but it's probably for the most part also a very under-recognized community of people as well, I would think.
Very much so. And I've found that, especially since I've started doing this work and really talking about it more, people are so very quiet about their caregiving experience. And I understand it. I was too when I was in that space. But being so quiet, I feel like doesn't serve the greater good, because every generation has caregivers and caregiving, and we're aware of it. But since we don't talk about it, when we get thrown into it, because we always feel like we're thrown into it because we're never expecting it. It's not like you schedule like, honey, can you get cancer in, you know, 2025 instead, because it's really not convenient now.
Right.
So we're always caught off guard. And because we don't talk about it, nobody knows what to expect.
Yes. Yeah. Would you mind telling us a little bit about your story? I know we just briefly touched on it in your bio.
Sure, absolutely. So my husband was diagnosed with liver cancer. And again, very unexpected. He wasn't feeling sick. He didn't have symptoms. He wasn't jaundicey, nothing like that. We were going to Africa on vacation. And so the only reason he even went to the doctor was to get vaccinations. And because he hadn't been in so long, they're like, let's do labs. Let's do the whole physical, the whole thing. And the labs came back kind of irregular. And they said, when you come back, you'll see a specialist. And when we came back, they were like, didn't they tell you you have cancer and you need a transplant? And we were like, the face that you're making right now.
Yeah.
Popping out of your head. That's where we're like, you are mistaken. It's not my husband. You are talking about somebody else. And then we moved a few times along the way. So we actually went through the transplant intake process 3 different times. So we were exposed to a lot of different doctors, a lot of different medical teams, different procedures. And so it gives me also that unique perspective from a caregiver's point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And I do like to clarify, which I would like to hop in and say, he is great now. There were complications in so many surgeries and so many things. And I mean, I was a caregiver for well over a decade, but he had his transplant. He is 3 years cancer-free. We're celebrating his 7-year transplant anniversary this year, and he's doing fantastic.
Good, good. Yeah, but I think there's also that advocacy piece that I don't think comes up very much either. You know, I always try to encourage anyone I'm working with to be their own, you know, biggest advocate, because I feel like in today's healthcare environment, we really have to be. I mean, me also being a healthcare worker in the hospital field, still, I completely understand, you know, the overworked, you know, not enough resources in our hospitals. And so things do fall through the cracks, even if your provider is on his or her toes every day, all day, you know, but let's be realistic. Physician and physician burnout is real. Caretaker, caregiver is also a real thing, burnout. I feel like there's this approach or perspective of compassion. I think it's really easy for a lot of us to like really highlight everything that's wrong or, you know, with the experience that we're going through, whether it's a cancer journey, a transplant journey, even if it's a chronic illness. But so let's talk about that a little bit, like in terms of being the caregiver, how you navigated that.
And really, and I just like to jump back one second because you mentioned the medical professionals. In addition to being overworked, they're also human.
Mm-hmm.
And caregivers are human. And people, you only know what you know. You only know what you can see. And they do their best. They do their best. We all do our best. And as a caregiver, I mean, I was fortunate that everything we went through, for the most part, was all pre-pandemic, because I lived at the hospital. I slept there. During the time we were in Texas, my husband had a major liver resection surgery where they removed a third of his liver that had really the cancer tumors, and they were hoping to avoid a transplant. I didn't leave. They thought in the cafeteria that I worked there because I ate every meal there. I didn't go home. Maybe quickly to shower and then back, but I slept there and I lived there. And that was my life for, he was in there, I think, over a week.
Yeah.
When he had his transplant here in Florida, the care was a little different because the surgery was a little different. So there was a dedicated floor for transplant patients. Mm-hmm. The nurse to patient ratio was excellent. And so when the night shift came on, I felt very comfortable going home to rest and then get up at 5 a.m, hit the Starbucks drive-through to get my caffeine and be at the hospital by the time rounds started. But again, that was also my life. It completely revolved around his medical care. And even in the hospital, the nurses did their thing, but I fed him, I bathed him, I fixed the pillows. I did all of those things. And I don't know how they would have, honestly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So your book is called Welcome to Caregiving, The Things Caregivers Never Talk About. And it also, you also have a companion planner, which I think is really a genius concept to have those two resources together, called the Patient Handbook. So I'm definitely going to give you a chance to talk all about those, but what are some of those things that as caregivers we never talk about?
Oh, we don't talk about our feelings. Everything is always fine. I was fine all the time. Always fine. Mm-hmm. And part of that in not talking about the feelings is because we are, I feel like, conditioned to believe that we have, quote, bad feelings. So if we're feeling angry or frustrated, we start to feel guilty for having those feelings. The fear, maybe not so much, but that anger and frustration for not being able to live the lives we had planned because everything stops. Mm-hmm. You can feel bad about that. There are days, you know, I would drive my husband to his appointments, and no matter how many drugs he had in his system, he would still tell me how to drive.
I love that.
They didn't give me drugs, but he had all the drugs. And he still knew how to get in this lane, get around that guy, watch that bump. And it was like, it made me just as mad as it did as if he was not sick.
Right.
But then I felt bad. So feelings are a big thing. Asking for help was super, super hard for me. I have been doing a lot of work on healing my own codependent tendencies, and some of those qualities made me a fantastic caregiver. I have learned now that there are things I could have done to soften that journey a lot. And that's what I'm trying to help people do, is soften the journey, because changing yourself in the middle of this kind of event it's not practical to change your core self when you're living a trauma.
Right.
But I didn't know how to ask for help. I didn't know how to receive help. And I was so overwhelmed, I didn't even know what to ask for. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of navigating in that. And even things, you know, a lot of people in general don't talk about their sex lives, but these kinds of things, it affects your entire life. It affects every facet of your life, whether you're caring for a spouse, a parent, a child. When you've taken on all these other, I like to call them the other duties as assigned,
mm-hmm.
it affects how you show up in other areas of life.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, in some ways, I feel like it's somehow common sense that it affects area of your life, but I feel like until you've really been through it and or been close to someone that's going through it and trying to be as supportive as you can to that person, then we don't really understand how much it affects, you know, like a career. Were you working during this or trying to, or had you
have
to put
I
that
was.
On hold?
Yes. And it was interesting because both my husband and I at the time were self-employed, which offered some really great things. Like, I didn't have to ask anybody's permission to take care of him.
Mm-hmm.
My schedule was completely flexible. On the flip side, if I wasn't working, I wasn't making any money.
Right.
So as a massage therapist, yes, I had clients that I had to put on hiatus. Some people were super gracious about that. Others called me while I was at the hospital and were like, well, I need to schedule the massage for me and my daughter before she goes back to college. So when can I get my massage? I was just like, I don't know, because my husband might be dying right now. So I can't.
Right.
I'm sorry that I can't help you right now. And so, yeah, that balance was definitely challenging. When I wrote my book, I talked to caregivers who were employed, and it was really hard for them. There were folks that I talked to who had sales quotas they had to meet while caring for a parent with Alzheimer's, and they couldn't do it. And so they ended up just making up their numbers so they didn't lose their job, because otherwise they were out of work. And so, yeah, there's a lot that comes into play.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't sound like you had to move through this aspect of the journey, but even finding, like you did mention, you know, Alzheimer's situation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of times that disease state will take the patient to a point where they can't live on their own and or even in a household with a caregiver anymore. And I think, because I'm starting to see some of my friends go through this with other family members. And even that next step, just because they are not in your household, doesn't mean that that's not also like another level of worry and stress. And,
absolutely.
You know, because you still want to be present for that family member, for that loved one. And then, you know, if it's complicated by different things that happen as we age and as we don't move as much. So even navigating the healthcare field, like if you have to find like a place that provides wound care and or, you know, a memory care center, do they offer those things together? Actually, a lot of them don't. So then what, you know, like, and how did you handle that piece of almost like just the navigating of the medical resources? I don't even know if that's the best way to say it, because you did say you moved several times.
We did move, and I was also the kind of caregiver that didn't ask for help. So there may have been more out there that was available to me, but it didn't feel like it was readily available, which is why I created some of the resources I did, because I got to the point where like I was writing notes on the backs of receipts and I couldn't find things, and I tried to research and like everything. And I'm a very organized person by nature. So I was like, why does this not exist? I don't understand.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so But finding the resources was a challenge as well.
So let's talk a little bit about that piece of this. I feel like it's a bundle that you've put together. The patient handbook itself. Tell us about that piece specifically.
It's very interesting because the patient handbook is like where everything started for me. The book came after because people are like, well, you need to tell the story that goes along with this book. Okay. But the book, because like I said, I'd be writing on the backs of receipts, trying to keep track of things and then trying to put it in my computer. And I tried to find a calendar planner that was appropriate, but the boxes were too small and none of it worked out. And so I actually created a binder system because I do acknowledge not everybody's brain works the same way mine does. So I put it in a binder and I created sections to help with the organization. So there is a full paper calendar. And I love my phone and we all love our technology. But sometimes being able to look at it all spread out and on the t days when the Wi-Fi is not working in the hospital and you need to write down an appointment or say, yes, I saw this specialist on the first and we saw the other specialist on the 15th, it's really nice to have paper. I added a section for keeping track of medications because they ask every time you walk in the door. I never was prepared with the list of the medications ever. And
As
they
a
ask you, what are
pharmacist,
you
I love that.
taking? Right. And everybody blanks out. What medicines are you taking? It's like, what medicines? And we don't know what they do and we don't know how much. And so it's in the binder. I created a body scan checklist. So it has a human silhouette and then also just some dot points that take the patient through the body so that they can get in tune with what they're feeling before they see the doctor. And
Oh, I love that.
so they can get in tune with themselves, they can communicate with the caregiver, they can connect and then prepare their questions so that when they meet the doctor, they know what they're asking, they know what they're feeling. I don't know about your audience. I get white coat syndrome big time.
A lot of people
The
do.
doctor walks in, the adrenaline kicks in, things that were hurting might not hurt anymore. Like when you go to the mechanic and the car is not making the noise anymore, happens to my body. And then the second I leave, I have forgotten everything they say. It happens to me every time. And so on the appointments pages, I have a place for everyone to write down like their vitals. So you can keep track of those things yourself. You have the place where you've written down your questions from your body scan checklist. And the flip side is the doctor's responses. And I added a little box for gratitude so that when you're in that moment, sitting in the waiting room, you can say, okay, what good thing is happening right now? Like something to be grateful for to really ground us. Because when you're in the middle of medical, whether it's chronic pain or major medical, whatever the situation is, I mean, I use it for my annual care. I keep the same binder and keep track of everything, and it's very handy to flip back. But being able to ground into that gratitude, really, it helps me a lot.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, even just being grateful that I was able to get this appointment.
Yes. I'm going to the doctor next week. I'm seeing one of my specialists, and so I was going over my past notes and I wrote, I'm thankful for the person who was able to like expedite my referral request so I could see my specialist. And I was like, oh, that's right, that happened. I didn't, yeah.
Yeah,
So
because I think so much of the time, too, I know both as a patient and a caregiver, when there's something wrong, we want it like seen, assessed, diagnosed, taken care of like yesterday.
yes.
And unfortunately, that's just not the pace that our medical system moves for so many reasons. I think the main one is that it's a human-created system. We're not perfect, so the system's not perfect either. And we live in this planet that actually has a spectrum of time to it. It's not
Oh, time.
oh, time.
Do we want to talk about time?
So, but again, just reminding ourselves, like, I love that you brought that in, the gratitude. So, with that, let's also sort of transition into the other self-care approaches that you found like really helpful, or that you've seen as themes throughout this community, maybe.
One of the biggest things I learned about self-care during my journey was that I really hate the term self-care. And I really struggled with it, talking about it in my book and writing about it. And I didn't want to call it that because I feel like, you know, I forget how many billions of dollars the self-care industry is in this particular moment, but it's many billions of dollars. And so I feel like it's become something overwhelming and frivolous, and people don't necessarily take it to heart as self-care. Mm-hmm. And so I like to refer to it more as taking a pause, because especially as caregivers, you're not, maybe you don't have an hour to go to the spa or get a massage. Like, you're literally living your life moment to moment. And so having awareness about what you're feeling and where you're coming from, finding little moments to pause. And I'm talking about like taking the shower and buying the body wash that smells good. So those 3 minutes that you have in the shower, you can be present in that time and enjoy that scent and get grounded.
And be grateful.
And I'm talking about, you know, when you get the half hour to go to the grocery store, you sit in the car for the extra 3 minutes and listen to your favorite song and like sing it at the top of your lungs.
Mm-hmm.
And so taking those little pauses and finding little ways to celebrate what you're already doing for yourself. So you don't have to instill a whole bunch of new things. Like people used to say, what are you doing to take care of you? And I'd be like, it felt like another thing to add to my to-do list. And I couldn't take it.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't, it was like, not doing self-care is my self-care. Like I do not, don't talk to me about it. Don't like, no. But if I had had more of that mindset of, hey, yeah, what am I doing for myself? I get to celebrate today, maybe with a flavored coffee.
Yeah.
That I heard my alarm and I got up and I am safely moving through traffic, and I get to stop and celebrate that moment. Not the best circumstances, but I can pause and celebrate. So awareness, pausing, and celebrating the little things.
Well, I think this brings up for me too, just even the concept of, like you said before, like this whole, the term self-care, the self-care industry has, I think, maybe even been manipulated by the media to seem more shallow than it actually is. Like, mm-hmm. It's super important. And so it's interesting to me, like, maybe what we should also be talking about is that before we even get to that point of being a caregiver, that we start building those self-care practices in now, so that when you're asked that question, your answer is, well, I do this, this, and this, and I was doing it before, and I'm definitely continuing to do it now. And, you know,
and that's part of my hope in getting in speaking of it myself, and hopefully opening the doorway for other caregivers to speak as well, that mm-hmm. people can learn from that and start building those foundations so that we aren't caught so off guard when something comes up that we need to step into, whether it's caregiving or another unfortunate or traumatic event in our lives, that we have a little more bend and a little more kindness towards ourselves, a little more grace.
Yeah. Cause I, you know, I'm also feeling like a lot of new moms go through this. I mean, I think that's probably our first segue into the field of caregiving, like really putting so much focus on something other than ourselves. Mm-hmm. out of a necessity, really, you know, it's like this new human life demanding your time and attention.
Yes. and then having that food from your body. Feelings and that same guilt. I've had more than one person say that to me, like, are you sure you're not talking about being a mom? It's like, not because then when you step away from taking care of that new baby, a lot of moms feel guilty about doing that and taking that time for themselves. And
Well, I'm so glad your husband is doing well.
Yes,
is what else would you like to bring forward around this topic that we haven't broached yet?
Oh, let's see. What else have we not talked about? I mean, I feel like there's so much.
Mm-hmm. Are there like maybe coping mechanisms for the feelings? Like, you talked about how like the feelings aren't really talked about to begin with, but then once you're maybe to that point to where you're willing to even recognize these emotions for yourself and admit that you're having them? Is there a process that you went through to sort of like say, like, it's okay to have this feeling? Like, I'm a human, I'm allowed to have the feeling. That doesn't mean I don't love my husband any less. And I'm not, you know, I'm not going to run for the hills, but right. I'm going to have this feeling.
And for me, a lot of it came to me in hindsight as part of the writing of the book. And I actually entitled sections "In Hindsight," because I tell these stories and these kooky things that I did. And like, in looking back, I can see why I did this crazy thing or behaved this way, because this is where I was. And so the process of reflection, I think, is important. And that's really, it's so different for everybody. I did not journal for at all in my adult life, probably until like within the last year or 2 years. And I think if I had used that as a tool a little bit more, that could have helped me just for myself to get it physically out of my body with, you know, through a pen onto paper. And you don't have to keep these things. They're really not meant to be reread and, you know, cherished for future. It's a tool to get it out of you and then shred it, crumple it, burn it.
I love burning ceremonies because right? like it's out and now I'm literally transmuting and transforming it back to the universe in the realm of smoke and fire.
Absolutely.
How therapeutic is that?
Amazing. I did have, I had excellent therapists through the process, which I also understand. I mean, that is a process of trial and error. I have seen a lot of therapists. Have my favorites, but having somebody to talk to, and especially if you're a caregiver, I found there are therapists that specialize in caregiving. It is their entire wheelhouse. And so that's something that you can look for if you don't have somebody you're already comfortable working with. And so, you know, those two things I think are really strong. Some people, you know, might be comfortable, you know, taking their break, maybe sitting on their porch. If you can get away to go to the beach and just try to ground and meditate. I also did not have I had zero meditation practice at the time. So I didn't have any of those kind of more natural calming tools. So I was in a very constant state of fight or flight always, which ended up making me very sick.
Yeah. So that's another thing that we haven't really talked about, that is that so many caregivers get sick on their own through this journey,
because
I think not only just because they're not making themselves a priority, but that constant state of fight, flight, worry, fear, frustration, all the vibration of those emotions creates such a discord. And you know, that's how you're living. I feel like if we're just moving through it in a reactive, unconscious manner. And so like, even like having the aha of, okay, I need to be present. And almost like you said, like, how do you go through a self-healing journey of your own when you're taking care of someone else?
Right.
But yeah, it's, wow. What a dichotomy. I think
it really is, which kind of circles us back to that point of the more we can talk about it and teach people the importance of just some of these baseline tools, then you have something to fall back on. But you know, my husband and I, we joke, and it shouldn't be a joke, but I tell people it took me probably twice as long to recover from his transplant than him. Because I carried a lot, all of it. There was a process. He had complications after the transplant, and he was so out of it that he wasn't even aware. And so like, I carried all of that, and I carried it for both of us. And it wasn't until after, when doctors and surgeons were coming in saying, oh my gosh, we were so worried about you. I was calling in from vacation. You know, we weren't sure if you were going to make it. And when the doctors admit that to you, you'd know it was a pretty grim situation.
Yeah.
And I remember my husband standing there just in the exam room looking out the window, and he said, I really almost died, didn't I? I said, yeah, you really did almost die. And so for me to be able to recover from that, because, you know, brain doesn't know if you're thinking of the future or the present. And so I was also grieving. I was grieving the loss of him, even though I hadn't lost him yet. Mm-hmm. And so my body was going through that process as well.
So that brings up a question for me, like when you're looking for mental health support, and you said there are counselors and therapists that focus on caregivers and caregiving specifically, I was going to ask, would grief also like be an appropriate specialist to look for, even if your person doesn't pass away?
I feel like it could be. I feel like it's definitely something that comes up for caregivers. I think you are launched into that cycle possibly very prematurely because that is where your brain goes. You're worried about them dying. You're saddled with the responsibility of keeping them alive.
Mm-hmm.
I explained to people every time I filled my husband's pillbox every Sunday morning, I relived a trauma because I knew that those pills kept him alive. I knew if I messed them up, he could die. And therefore I was responsible for his life. Mm-hmm. And so every Sunday morning when I filled that pillbox, that was a life or death situation for me.
Right. Yeah, that's huge. Huge. And I think like it sounds so simple and even maybe mundane to some, like filling the pillbox once a week.
Yeah.
But yeah, when you're saddled with the possibility of those consequences, I think, yeah, I mean, it seems only natural that your body would go into fight or flight, which, you know, is really like when we imprint a traumatic experience into our cellular makeup. And because more and more, we are actually scientifically being able to confirm that, yes, our traumas are held in our cells. They are literally held in our body. And unless we consciously let process and release and let go, they'll hang out there forever, really, until, you know, we release this physical vessel back to the earth. So
I've been learning so much about that recently, more about the somatic healing and everything, and actually that process of, if you can't eventually complete the cycle of the fight or flight, it will stay in your body. And so you need to be able to feel all the things and let your body do all of the things to complete the cycle before it will move. Otherwise, yes, it takes up residence, which leads to our chronic pain and the chronic syndromes and things which caregivers are hugely susceptible to.
Mm-hmm. And just so everyone's aware of, like, when she says complete the process, that means crying, that means yelling, that means getting angry, that means allowing yourself to feel all the feelings, that means allowing yourself to shake. I don't know if anybody out there has ever watched a Nature Channel show of a predator and a prey chase. If the prey gets away, you'll usually see them do this whole tremor, full body tremor thing until, you know, their body has worked through it, released it, and now they go back to their homeostasis. You know, they know they're not being chased anymore. And as humans, we just don't let ourselves do that. We stop it. We resist the emotions. We resist all the things. So like you said, finding a practitioner of some sort to allow your, that creates a safe space so that you can move through those emotions and any physical reaction that you need to have to get it out, you know, allow it to move through you so that it does come out and then you can come back to homeostasis.
Thank you for that explanation.
Okay. What else? Is there anything, you know, else that you really want to bring to the forefront that we haven't talked about yet?
Really just that the resources, because I know we've talked about some big things and big mm-hmm. feelings, and it can feel, even just what we've talked about, like overwhelming. So if there's a caregiver listening right now, they might be going, oh, okay, yeah, I'm not going to do all that right now. And maybe now is not the time for that. And so that's why I'm trying to create just more resources of those small tools to help mm-hmm. soften that journey. Not try to change who you are right now. It's not the time for big mental shifts and
right.
Shift in your approach to life. If you're codependent, like I was, maybe not the time to completely revamp everything you're doing, But there are things that you can do to soften that journey for yourself to make it just a little bit easier so that your recovery on the other side can go a little bit smoother.
So true. So true. I would definitely say, listen to your body, listen to your spirit and your soul. And, you know, where is it guiding you? Where is it leading you? Maybe you are at the point to where you can implement a 5-minute meditation practice while you're in the shower, you know, combining those opportunities. And, or maybe you're like, I know eventually my body is going to want to complete the cycle, but I don't have time for that now. Now is not the time, but I'm going to put it on my list. And so when I get through this, then I'll maybe allow myself that space. And that's okay too. Because I think all of it is coming from self-love, self-compassion, and self-care, which is really the whole point of us having this conversation today, was bringing, you know, light and awareness to all of these things, which just aren't really talked about. You know, I think being a caregiver could probably really feel also really isolating and lonely and
very much so,
and segregating. So, anyone out there, know that you're not alone. There, you know, are, I'm sure, thousands, if not millions of people going through what you're going through at this exact moment, and that there are resources out there for you. Tell us, Erin, where people can find you and the resources that you have so lovingly put together.
The best way to find me and everything that I do is on my website, which is erincopeland.com. And that's Erin with an E, Copeland, no D. So, and cool. That has all my resources and the book and the handbook and my free downloads, and everything is there.
Okay. Yes. Awesome. And again, the name of her book is Welcome to Caregiving, The Things Caregivers Never Talk About, and that the Patient Handbook, which is the title of it. So is the companion guide. So definitely check it out. Go to her website. If you find yourself in this situation, or maybe it's not you, but you know someone, you know, if they're open and ready for some support resources, definitely either send this episode or Erin's website over to them. Thank you, Erin, so much. I appreciate your time. And
thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.